netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. Today, Mike Seymour talks with Paul Franklin, visual effects supervisor on Inception. Before we get to that, I just wanted to mention, we just completed SIGGRAPH 2010. So many great people came up to talk to us. So we had a meetup, an FX PhD meetup one night. About 50 people turned out. Very nice time. Just so great to get to meet everybody from the forums at FX PhD and in the classes and other professors that I haven't met, for example. Anyway, it's just a great time, and SIGGRAPH was exhausting. But before we went to SIGGRAPH, we got a chance to go see Inception. And I know if you're like me, you've been looking forward to this film since you first heard about it, knowing Christopher Nolan's history and reputation. And also this podcast we've been much anticipating because of Paul Franklin. He's been a great guest before, talking with us about The Dark Knight, Batman Begins, and Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix. I should warn you that this is a there's a lot of spoilers. If you haven't seen the film, I would recommend seeing the film before you listen to this podcast. There's a great discussion about a lot of the work in the film. The Double Negative was the sole vendor on this film, except for some miniature work by New Deal. Mike and Paul will discuss the film and also some bigger issues, talking about things like posting on set and pipeline for such large-scale scenes as seen in this film. Let's jump in now to the interview with Paul Franklin.
And Paul, welcome back to the show. We always enjoy talking to you. Congratulations on the film.
Thank you very much, Mike. It's great to be here. I always enjoy being on the show.
I was wondering if I could, before we get into specifics of some shots, just discuss some of the sort of broader issues that I think your perspective would be really interesting to hear. I'm here at SIGGRAPH as I'm recording this, and Joe Leteri yesterday, in a discussion about Avatar, and I'm sort of paraphrasing, said there is no more post, since basically you need to get everything pretty much sorted out before principal photography. And when before I actually came to Los Angeles, I was talking to another, actually one of the founder of Lightiron in LA, Michael Conti, and he was saying that the biggest move in post at the moment is to post on set, because it's just so important to sort stuff out on set. And by that, they mean not just nod that that's the right kind of element that you might need, but actually kind of plan it out. I mean, is this an opinion that you would share?
Well, I definitely think that Joe Leteri's observation that post is finished is increasingly true. And I think part of that is down to the fact that films now, the visual effects are so involved that they really do just have to start right at the beginning of pre-production in terms of the planning and the development of the ideas. But also I think it's that there's a new generation of film directors that embraces that whole way of working, that doesn't just see post visual effects as being something that is an add-on and an afterthought. So even when the work is not that involved, they are now looking to bring on the visual effects people at an early stage, because I think they realize they get a better result in the end.
And I mean, just being blunt about it, and no disrespect to anyone, but obviously some sets, if you go back 5-10 years, it was really also a bit of a thing with the DOP, because the DOP really is kind of the de facto head of the on-set crew. And there was a bit of a thing about, well, you know, the DOP kind of defined the look, and these visual effects guys were there, and that was a bit outside their control. But it seems also not just the directors, but the DOPs that have moved around to that collaborative nature with visual effects.
Oh, very definitely. I think the cinematographers that are out there now realize that a lot of what visual effects is doing is attempting to blend seamlessly with their work. So that, you know, you shouldn't really see any difference between the visual effects and the work of the cinematographer. So it's very much in the DOP's interest that they get the VFX guys on board, and that the VFX guys then, you know, understand and absorb what it is that the cinematographer is trying to achieve. Every cinematographer has a unique style, and you know, VFX, you're looking to try and capture that. So, yeah, it's definitely something that's happening more and more, I think.
So now, one of the interesting things about this film, which, I mean, there's about 1,000 interesting things about this film, but one thing from my point of view is interesting about this film, is the singularly interesting decision that Dineg pretty much was the primary house on all the visual effects work. And not only that, but you did the previs on this as well, right?
Yeah, well, Double Negative was the sole vendor on the show, with the exception of the miniature work that was done at New Deal Studios. All the digital visual effects were all Double Negative, and I was invited to come and read the script. Chris called me up whilst I was on holiday with my family in Los Angeles, and I went round to the Syncope office on the Warner's lot. That Syncope is Chris and Emma's film production company. And I got to read the script in its first draft, under more or less armed guard. So they locked me away in a little office, and I had a couple of hours to read it. And it was great, because right from the very beginning, you know, you were involved in the whole process of developing the ideas, developing the whole thing. And that's something that Chris wanted to do. He wanted to bring the visual effects people in very early, just like we were just talking about, and really to integrate me and Double Negative into the whole production pipeline of the film. So there's no separation between the vendor and the rest of the production.
Which, of course, helped from the fact that you'd obviously done two very strong films with him before.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I think that, you know, that's key to the whole relationship, was the fact that we had a track record on the Batman films, and that Chris was very happy with the work we did on those shows, and that we got on together, you know, that whenever I had to interact with him on those films.
But I mean, if I was to talk about a cliched film, a theoretical film that I often sort of hear about as an amalgam of discussions we have, it'd be like a company's brought in to do the previews, and then there's like a handover of the previews to independent VFX supervisor who is also then dealing that out to multiple facilities, and then you're trying to get consistency across the playing field. But in this case, your team produced previews, which kind of really just melted through to a refined stage to a final, didn't it?
Yes, it did. And I mean, that kind of reflects Chris's whole attitude towards previews as well, which is that, you know, Chris is famously a director who doesn't use previews. At least that's the sort of public perception within the rest of the industry. But the reality is that Chris does use previs, but he uses it very sparingly, and he uses it primarily effectively a sort of extension of the concept design process. That we don't use previs to block out whole sequences and work out where the cuts are going to be and all the different camera angles. He uses it more for the conceptual design of individual shots, individual moments in the film. So previs starts where effectively concept design leaves off. So when you've gone as far as you can with the illustrations and you need to work out something that's more about how the shot lives and breathes, how things are moving around, that's when we get into previs. And, you know, Chris had always been very appreciative of the previs work that we'd done on the Batman films, for things like the sequence with the Batpod coming out of the Batmobile was a good example of something that we developed through a previs process. You know, he wanted to take that further, and he had also appreciated the fact that, you know, I do quite a bit of the previs myself, hands on with the computer, so I could do things whilst I was over there in LA, and then also I could call upon the guys and the rest of the team who were doing things back in London, and then sending them over the internet, and I could get ideas in front of them very, very quickly that way.
In fact, wasn't it true that he was walking around with your laptop in Paris?
Yes, that was actually. That was a great piece of work. We were discussing the whole Paris street folding sequence, and one of our artists, Alison Wartman, she came up with this fantastic bit of previs, which pretty much is the shot you see in the final movie. And Chris liked it so much that when he was describing it to Leo and Ellen, first he had me get my laptop out of my rucksack and show them the animation, which was on my computer. And then he walked off with the laptop and kept running the animation and used its timings to cue Leo and Ellen so that they knew where they were supposed to be looking as the imaginary city arched overhead.
Yeah, I mean, I know that, like on the Bond films, for example, they can have up to six units working, and that's not unprecedented in terms of a live-action thing, but it does seem that there's vastly more use of multiple vendors in this one department of visual effects than there is in almost any other. So it's very terrific that you guys got that. Because there's, what, about 500 shots in this?
Yes, we had 560 shots turned over, and we delivered 500 shots in the movie.
I mean, shot count is such a crappy way of determining how much somebody
did. I mean, probably a better way of describing it is that we had a team of about 220 people working on the show at various points over at Double Negative, plus all the guys that we had on set and in the in the production side visual effects department. So all in, it's probably closer to 275 people.
Clearly, Chris is a significant director, one of the most significant directors of our generation. He presumably also has an enormous amount of sway with the studio. So did that lead you to having a more relaxed post schedule, or rather period between end of principal photography and delivery, or was it a rush?
Well, the post schedule was certainly not relaxed. The we did this film in terms of between turnover and final delivery of the shots, we had about 4.5 months, and the shots were pretty big and demanding. And one of the things that Chris is quite famous for is that he pretty much wants finished shots for his temp screening of the movie. So we had to crank out pretty much complete versions of everything about a month and a half into the post schedule. So it was pretty tight. But what it did mean is that obviously Chris has got a lot of clout with the studio, and he was able to get everybody on board with the idea of me supervising the show and Double Negative doing all the work, because it was important to Chris that he really just wanted one point of contact. He wanted one person who was speaking with a clear voice for everybody who was working in the visual effects department, and so that's why he approached me, and then pretty much insisted on Double Negative doing all the work.
You must have had a very strong sort of 3D supervisor, 2D supervisor on this project, because you must have been doing stuff while you're on set.
Yes, absolutely. My own background is that I came out of 3D graphics and CG supervision. So there's a fair amount I could do myself on set in terms of knowing what was going to work and what wasn't going to work. But I was then backed up by a team from Double Negative who were with me all the time.
Okay, sorry, I just wanted to clarify that. What I meant was that not far from discussing it in terms of your skills, no, it was just in terms of, like, you would have been tied up on set and you must have had back in London
concurrently. Yes, I see what you mean. No, yes, absolutely. No, I'm very lucky in that obviously Double Negative has been around for a reasonable amount of time now. We've been going for 12 years now, since 1998. And as a result, I have the luxury of working with a pretty regular team of people that I've worked with for quite a few years now. And what we had over at Double Negative, we had two in-house VFX supervisors, Andy Lockley and Peter Bebb. And Andy and Peter are respectively Andy's effectively the 2D lead on the show, and Peter is the 3D lead on the show. And the same guys, Andy and Peter, work with me on Batman Begins and also on The Dark Knight. And Peter and I go all the way back to the very beginning of Double Negative, and Andy joined us in about, it'd be the year 2000 on my first show as a VFX supervisor. So you've got to, having that kind of relationship with the guys, they know exactly how you're thinking, you know exactly how they're thinking, and you don't really have to have too much discussion about what to do. They just know the right things to do.
Because, to deliver good temps a month and a half in is just mind-blowing to me. They must have been working really hard during principal photography.
It was working pretty hard. What you do is you spend a lot of time, you do as much as you can to build all the assets and get the pipeline locked down tight. And this was something we learned, the hard way doing Batman Begins, because this is something that Chris has always insisted on. So Batman Begins was going through the pain barrier, learning how to build a pipeline that could deliver material on that kind of tight turnaround. And then we did it again on Dark Knight, and so by the time we got to Inception, we knew what we were in for, and so we were planning for it right from the outset.
Well, there are clearly very strong 2D type problems that you guys had to solve and 3D type problems, so let's probably delve down into individual sequences if we could, and then we'll sort of maybe discuss those two different styles. And I'm going to just, if I can, there's a ton of stuff we could discuss, and I don't mean to not discuss any of the work that some of your team may be disappointed that we're not going to discuss, but I just thought if we just picked on three bits from the film, then we might be able to get some insightful depth on that. And I'm going to start actually with the weightlessness stuff, because I think it's probably the stuff that you remember most when you leave the cinema. It was just so remarkable. And I think most people now, just from the popular press, would know that there was a moving rig. But when I was watching it, I knew that there was a moving rig. What I was kind of stunned by was just how far beyond wire removal it seemed to get by the point at which the characters were being wrapped up in cable and then pulled through in a weightless environment. I was expecting kind of a weightless fight. What I got was really a weightless environment. How hard was that to do?
Well, the waveless environment was it takes its lead entirely from the wire work that was done, and it's amazing what you can achieve if you cleverly set that up. And one of the key things to that was the fact that rather than have people suspended in front of us, you know, hanging down in front of the camera, we built this set which was on its end, and so the actors are then lowered on their wires towards the camera. And the wires are hidden behind the actors. And so instead of getting a sort of pendulum-type action as they swing from side to side, the pendulum action becomes more than bouncing backwards and forwards across the corridor. And then that becomes very, very difficult to understand visually. And so especially once you've taken the wires away. The key thing with the wire removal was that Chris didn't want to be encumbered by any kind of restrictions on the movement of the camera or the movement of the actors. So right at the very beginning of the show, we had to kind of completely embrace the fact that he was going to shoot what he wanted to shoot and we were going to have to deal with it later on. And, you know, we were talking earlier about making sure that things are planned properly and designed properly. And a key thing there was our relationship with the other departments on the film, in particular the stunt department, special effects, art department and costume. I can't overstate the contribution that the costume department made, just in little consideration of things like, you know, designing costumes that didn't flop about and give away which direction the vertical was in, adding little tweaks like just the shoelaces on the guy on Joseph Gordon-Levitt's shoes were stiffened so they would always look like they were just, you know, sticking out in zero gravity rather than flopping about in the direction of his travel. And it was cool little things like that really helped us out.
Now, was it just an extension of that to do the shot that I'm referring to or the sequence I'm referring to once they get moved from the bedroom through to the actual lift? Or was there – because it seemed to me that was really complicated.
Yes. Well, that built on the whole idea that we were using inside the corridor. And just as we had the whole corridor set that could be tilted – that was tilted on its end, tipped up so that the camera was pointing vertically up into it, we also had a couple of sets that could be rotated, and the hotel room, which was rotating during the spinning fight, as we called it, where Joe Gordon-Levitt is tumbling around the room with the subconscious security guard. We took that set and then we rotated it 90 degrees so that the doorway that you see them that they're heading towards is actually in the ceiling, and the wires are dropping down through that doorway, holding on to the big bunch of sleepers that are all spinning around. So they're actually spinning, rotating around their vertical axis, but the camera and the whole room is on its side,
right.
So that then becomes the horizontal axis. And what that meant was that we had a very, very extensive rig holding those guys. You know, they were basically wrapped inside a kind of cat's cradle of wires, and that required an awful lot of careful rotoscoping, rig replacement, and then repatching all the background behind them. The background, the rest of the room itself, the stunt department had cut great chunks out of the walls to admit the wire rigs. So we had these huge gaping holes in the set, and they had to be all repatched with a CG set extension. And then finally, one of the trickiest things was that as the stack of sleeping guys rotates round, it became very obvious that you weren't looking at the actors, you were looking at the stunt performers. Only Joe Gordon-Levitt was really up to doing the intensive wire work. He'd trained extensively for weeks beforehand with the stunt crew, and so he was an absolute natural for all the wire work. But the rest of the actors weren't too keen to be hung up in those wire rigs because they, you know, it must have been very, very uncomfortable. You know, half of the people in that stack are basically head down. And
yeah,
they're in those rigs for a long, long time. So
yeah,
it's, and they just have to sort of play dead and not move. But as the stack rotated round, it became obvious that you weren't looking at the actors. So in the last few weeks, just before delivery, we built CG heads of Ken Watanabe and Cillian Murphy and used those to replace the heads of the stunt performers. So just as Cillian and Ken come into view, you're looking at digital versions of their heads.
Had you always had a requirement to do digital doubles for them and you therefore were reusing assets, or was this a sort of you suddenly had to get them back for?
Well, no, this is something that we planned for.
Okay.
You know, you always make the assumption that well, you don't know what's going to come up, so you always cover yourself if you can by at the very least doing a photo documentation of the actors, the cast, and all their costumes. And we did that on every location we went to, with the where we thought there was a possibility we might need to do digital versions of the cast. We did photo documentations of them, and then whilst we were shooting all the hotel interiors in England, we did full cyber scans of the actors in full costume, and then close up scans of their heads, and that's what we built those digital doubles from.
I mean, wire removal doesn't get a lot of credibility when it comes to sort of discussions like these, but I guess having been an old compositor, the amount of wires that would have had to have been removed and the level of effortlessness in terms of the clothes not looking like they're being tugged and nothing looking like it's being pushed back and stuff, it must have really been an exceptional 2D team.
It was. You know, I have to say that I was extraordinarily impressed. And what was really impressive was that initially when we discussed all the wire removals with Chris, I was doing my usual thing of trying to say, look, you know, trying to get all the wires out for temps is going to be really difficult. In fact, it's not going to be possible. We're not going to be able to do it. So, you know, we need to agree on a level of rig removal that's acceptable for temps that tells the story. And Chris kind of nodded and said, yes, I see what you mean. Sure, fine. Well, obviously, you know, the work needs to speak to the story of the shots, and we need to focus on that. But when it came down to it, if there was any wires left in the shots, Chris wasn't happy. So he just kept pushing until we took all the wires out for temps. And we pretty much did, you know, completed rig removals for most of the temp shots. What this meant was that our kind of crew allocation that we had didn't really work, because we'd set it all up. We had all our rotoscope team, who are all very junior guys, all straight out of college, a lot of them. Or, you know, maybe only a year or two into working in visual effects. And the idea was they would do all the roto. We'd do basic rig removals, and then we'd bring in all the compositors, the experienced comp guys, after temps to complete the rig removals. But we had to get the rig removals done for temps. So the roto crew pretty much ended up doing the majority of the rig removals inside the hotel sequence. And I have to say, they did an absolutely fantastic job. It was amazing. And it was, you know, it's one of those things where you get so much more from people than you expect, that it's it just makes you, you know, feel really glad you're doing this job, really.
Yeah, what a great thing. And what were they sort of working on? What was the pipeline in terms of tools for that?
They were using a combination of our in-house build of Shake. We have our own 64-bit build of Shake at Double Negative. And we were also using a proprietary roto tool called Noodle, which is a spline-based roto package.
And I should have asked this before, I guess, but there was some interesting variety of cameras used on this. So what was the source material, and what was the format that you were working at?
Well, the all the stuff inside the hotel for the zero gravity sequence was shot on standard anamorphic, so 35mm anamorphic. I think the primary camera used was the Panavision Millennium 2000. And then we were also using Arri 435s, and these were all shot with these old C and E series anamorphic lenses that Chris and Wally Pfister, the DOP of the film, prefer. And these are basically some of the earliest anamorphic lenses that were made for use in movies. So they date back to the late 50s and the early 60s.
I haven't shot with those lenses, but I've shot with like Panavision anamorphic lenses.
Yeah.
And if you open those suckers up fully, like completely wide, you can actually get almost like a vertical smear or a chromatic aberration. It's not really chromatic, it's almost an illumin sort of ghosting. And then also an anamorphic lens, I guess most people just assume, is just an expansion in the x-axis, though they can also have a shear, in that the optical elements don't perfectly give you a straight up and down 90 degrees. Did you have any sort of, because that would really screw up 3D tracking, do you have any issues with any of the lenses?
Well, the key thing is you have to make sure you actually map all the lenses very, very accurately at the start of production. And Joe Wiemeyer, my on-set match mover, he supervised all of the shooting all the lens grids. And Joe was excellent. You know, whenever we got a new lens, because there were lenses being swapped out and refurbished all the way through production, he would immediately get on the case and make sure the thing was mapped. And that's the key to actually getting the whole thing to work. But we did have some strange behavior from some of the lenses. There was one lens in particular that we used in the Paris sequence, in the shot where the guys where Leo and Ellen walk up the wall.
Yep.
And that it wasn't producing a completely, you know, the aspect ratio was not, the pixels weren't square when we unstretched the image. It yeah. ended up being stretched. So we had to, because of course you could really see it as Leo and Ellen tipped over backwards, we had to pretty much rebuild the actors' heads as they went up the wall.
Wow.
Because it was a bit of a giveaway that something odd was happening as they tilted over backwards. Their heads stretched slightly. And Chris was very aware of this, and it bugged him a lot. So he made sure that we fixed that up.
Because, I mean, we take for granted now the quality of a modern lens that are built with, obviously, computer simulation of what the optical path would be like. So
yes.
while those older lenses are incredibly cool in many respects, you get lovely flares and all sorts of things, they really are a bit of a beast to... And so that mapping would be absolutely essential, I'm sure.
Oh, God, absolutely too, right. And this is... It's something that we knew what we were in for because we'd been through this on Batman Begins and on The Dark Knight. So the whole lens mapping pipeline was built originally for The Begins, but it's been consolidated and extended since then. And the guys have got very, very good at reproducing artifacts like the chromatic aberration and the edge flares that we get. And of course, all the, those beautiful complex anamorphic lens flares, which are a feature of the cinematography in these films.
Now, I'm going to come back to discussing Paris at the end. I want to jump, if I can, to Limboland, because it's a very obviously effect sequence in the sense that, no one for a second actually thinks a city is crumbling into an ocean. But you're in the environment where the rest of the film is dripping in realism and sort of visual credibility.
Yes.
And quite often in daylight. How hard was that to come up with a sort of glacial collapse of a city?
Well, that was one of the most rewarding sequences to work on. I mean, the whole thing was a rewarding experience throughout working on this project. But that was my personal favorite because this was something that Chris was really looking for visual effects to come up with a solution here for the basic design and look of Limbo City. And it was important to Chris that Limbo have several different ideas were embodied in the way that the buildings and the structure of the city appeared. And first off was the idea that when you appear on the shore, when you arrive on the shore of Limbo City, you're seeing the city collapsing back into the sea. The city is this mental construct deep inside Cobb's mind, and it's literally collapsing and dissolving back into the sea of his subconscious. And it was a fantastic visual metaphor for the kind of collapsing state of Cobb's mind as he's on the verge of losing it the whole time. You see this giant tottering precarious structure that represents this. Then the other thing was that the city Chris wanted the city to look like this. He wanted it to be a failed dream. It's the idea of a utopian city where one overall mind has designed and developed this whole thing, and a single architect has planned out the whole thing. And there's great examples of this throughout the history of modern architecture. Some of the plans that Le Corbusier had for rebuilding Paris, for example, in what was called the Voisin plan. And of course, these days we know these things as being these failed idealistic dreams. Whenever these big housing complexes have been put together, they generally sort of descend into chaos and disrepair. And more often than not, you see these things being demolished on the television, on the evening news and stuff, rather than people building new versions of these things. And that kind of architecture then also became, associated with the sort of oppressive nature of Soviet Russia or something like that. And so Chris wanted the city on the one hand, to be this sort of idealistic, pristine, pure space. And you see that when you get the flashbacks to Limbo, when Cobb's describing his time in Limbo with Mao. And then you see it in this sort of dystopian post-apocalyptic state, which is the sort of reality of where these dreams end up. And then the city itself was also a sort of history of modern architecture, which is something that Chris is very interested in, and I'm very interested in myself. And so I could really get into the whole idea of having this effectively this museum of architectural styles, which starts on the outskirts with early modernism featuring the buildings of the Bauhaus movement and Walter Gropius, who is the architect who designed the Bauhaus and is generally thought of by architectural historians as being the father of the skyscraper. And then as you move further and further into Limbo, you go through mid-century buildings, and eventually you end up in this this extraordinary space, which we actually shot downtown in Los Angeles at the Department of Water and Power, which is this fantastic 1960s skyscraper, which we then extended to make it impossibly tall. This is the building which is at the center of the square with all the mm-hmm. derelict houses sitting in it. And this building had echoes of the designs which you see in the film The Fountainhead with Gary Cooper as an aspiring architect. And that, which again, is something that Chris is very interested in. He likes the sort of themes of that book and the film. And so there's all sorts of little architectural references in there. But the key thing was like how to bring this all together, how to have this collapsing city, which is this idealistic place, and also this museum, and also this sort of post-apocalyptic place at the same time. And the first thing was to attack the design of the shoreline. And Chris wanted us to have something which, when you studied it carefully, you'd see that it was buildings and it was architecture and it was a city, but that perhaps from a distance it took on the aspect of a landform, a collapsing cliff face or something, that it looked like it was being eroded and washed away by the sea. And he pointed us in the direction of natural history footage of glaciers with great big icebergs carving off them and floating away into the sea. And he said, well, I want the city to take on the character of the glacier. And so we thought, okay, great. Well, let's get the concept artists going on this. And art department did some work, and the concept artist over at Double Negative also did some work. And I spent a lot of time discussing the kind of themes and ideas in Limbo City with Guy Dias, our production designer, because Guy had some fantastic ideas about how the buildings might be arranged in the city in terms of these giant grids of buildings marching off into the distance. But the problem with the concept process was that we couldn't really ever draw what Chris was describing. It was something more developed that he was looking for. If you just went into it as a drawing, you either ended up with pictures of cities embedded in glaciers, or cities made out of ice, or, you know, at the worst case, we ended up with basically Gotham City just sitting by the sea. And that wasn't what we wanted. We didn't want it to look recognizable as a city that you'd say, oh, well, I know that place, and they just went to New York and shot it and then stuck the sea in next to it. Chris wanted something that was fundamentally a lot weirder than that. And so I had an idea of, instead of trying to approach it through a conceptual design process, that we could maybe tackle it more as a procedural artwork, a procedural sculpture, in which we would start with the very basic principles of the city and the glacier, and then see if we could maybe iterate through versions of this thing to eventually get to something that could work for the film. And I've always been fascinated with the idea of procedural modeling, and particularly the idea of the concept of building cityscapes and whole environments procedurally. It's not something that we've ever really been able to apply any of the work we've done on the previous films, particularly on the Batman films, because you're building a much more recognizable environment. It doesn't really lend itself to a procedural approach. But it seemed like here we had the perfect opportunity to do this. So we started out by making a simple polygonal model of a glacier based on pictures of glaciers that we got from natural history footage from the Antarctic and things like that, BBC natural history documentaries and things like that. And we ended up with this simple polygonal cage, which looked like the glacier, sort of faceted version of the glacier. And then our software developers over at Double Negative, led by Nikki Hoyle, came up with a space-filling algorithm that populated the interior of the glacial mesh with simple architectural blocks, and the height and scale of the blocks being determined by the rising and falling profile of the glacier as it ran down the coastline. And then we pressed the button and had a look to see what it actually would give us. And it gave us effectively a sort of heavily pixelated, blocked out version of the glacier, when you could see the basic shape of the glacier still in there. And then we started iterating through it, adding more and more complex rules to this system, adding things like a rule that would say, okay, every four blocks, add an intersection. Every four intersections, make a big wide thoroughfare, or add a square or something like that. And then we would do things like we'd get it to vary the scales of the buildings depending on the slope of the glacier above it. So if it was a very steep slope, it would put smaller buildings underneath that so that it would actually get a finer detail in the profile. You'd have little steps of buildings rather than great big blocks of buildings to describe the edge of it. So we started adding things like subroutines, which would then look at the shape of the glacier and say, okay, well, here's a ravine in the face of the glacier. And we would use that to procedurally add damage and carve away from the buildings inside the inside the cityscape layout. And this went on for about 3 months or so. And eventually we ended up with this extremely complicated layered city, which is almost like a sort of like a hive of buildings layered into each other. And it's almost like the buildings are sort of mutating and blending into each other and packing more and more densely as they get closer and closer to the shore. And the great thing was that Chris had, you know, the faith in this whole process to just leave us alone for several months and just to get on with it, rather than the usual thing of, you know, going to art department and asking for some concepts and then being offered up a whole bunch of different drawings and then having that very, very quick feedback. This was by necessity, a very slow, iterative process. You know, it took quite a long time to get this all together. And then also, at the same time, we were also developing the whole CG pipeline to be able to handle the huge amount of detail that was going into this thing.
But also, one of the strengths, I think, of your workflow is you're very good at the kind of destructive, crumbling, believable structural crumbling, if that makes sense.
Yes. I mean, some of that was came from the procedural approach. So you were actually applying the erosion and damage from the glacier itself to the buildings to give it that sort of natural weathered landform sort of look. And some of it was just straightforward hand detailing. The CG team who put that together, put the finished version together for the film, they spent a lot of time looking at reference of collapsed and damaged buildings and derelict structures and bomb damaged structures from the Iraq War and things like that, looking how concrete roofs collapse and how modern buildings, which are reinforced concrete, collapse and fall apart. So that kind of detail comes from that intense research process that the guys went through. And then they also worked out all the kind of the surface treatments, all the paint work, the staining, the weathering, everything which gives it a sort of reality. And there's something that I impressed upon them, which I thought was really important, is that when you're doing these things, you have to think of, well, what's the story here? How did this building get like this? You know, rather than just ripping bits away from it and saying, okay, well, that's damaged, you have to say, okay, well, maybe if this bit comes out from the bottom, then this facade collapsed, and then that exposed all this rebar, and the rebar began to rust, and the rust ran down the building. So there's a little story told by all of the detail that's added to it, and I think it really holds up to scrutiny as a result.
Well, now if we're talking about detailing in buildings, we need to get back to Paris because if the sort of strongest memory for me was the fight scene and the stuff in the zero gravity, certainly the strongest visual for me was the folding of Paris. It was original, breathtaking, and could have looked kind of hokey and certainly did not. It looked really visually impressive, but there was an astonishing amount of building detail. Was this a level above what you'd done before?
Yeah, it really was. It was, in some ways you could look at it and say, well, it's just a consolidation on what we've done before, building Gotham and building complex environments like Baghdad in Green Zone. But the reality was it was like, you know, an order of magnitude more complicated than any of the things that we'd done on the Dark Knight, mainly because it was broad daylight. Those buildings in Paris are extremely ornate, with lots and lots of detailing, and each one of those blocks is unique. They have a sort of common architectural theme, but the actual detailing in terms of the porticos and window frames and surface reliefs are all unique to each block. They don't repeat themselves. And
You were not folding Gotham or folding Chicago. It was Paris.
Yes, absolutely. And so it had to hold up to incredible level of scrutiny because, you know, Wally's photography in the streets was pin sharp and fantastically detailed. And so the CG had to sit in there seamlessly next to it. So we had the guys out on location a couple of months before we went out to shoot with main unit. And they LiDAR'd all of the streets. And they took I think about a terabyte's worth of photographs of all the buildings and surveyed everything in exquisite detail, because we needed the buildings to be able to hold up, you know, pretty much full frame in camera. You know, there's the one shot where Leo and Ellen walk up the wall. Everything around them is a CG environment. There's no plate photography in that shot other than Leo and Ellen. And so everything had to hold up to that kind of level of scrutiny.
So just to drill on that, that was presumably a rotating green screen that they would walk from to?
Yes, we actually shot that little insert in Los Angeles on the very last day of principal photography in the United States. And Chris Corbold's team built this fantastic tilting set that actually had cobblestones and everything, and it even had the hinge that we designed between the two planes of the street. And Leo and Ellen would walk along this the flat bit, and as they came to the vertical bit, they'd put their feet up onto it, and then the whole thing would tilt over. So they stay on the horizontal, and the camera then goes with the set, and that gave us the appearance of them walking up the wall. But the you know, even though the cobblestones that art department had put in on the set looked pretty good, but they weren't quite the as close a match as we needed to the real location. So we ended up replacing all of that with a CG street surface.
Can I ask you a question about that? As almost an aside, but do you think that's because it's really hard to, no matter how great the team is, to get exterior lighting in a studio to look as good as you can now get with, I mean, you're using spherical harmonics or important sampling, but I mean, whatever you're using for your lighting rigs, you're presumably going for some kind of high-end lighting rig on the 3D, and it's almost like that is better now at modeling exterior lighting than some of the studio lighting you can pull off.
Well, I think certainly if you're trying to go for that very high contrast daylight look, then certainly, you know, CG lighting tools can now give you something which will give you that the drama and you know, the expression of an exterior lit scene that, as you say, it is quite difficult to reproduce on a stage. To actually be fair to that scene, we shot the tilting green screen was actually shot in natural daylight outside. Right. But we did have lights that then rotated with the set. And the idea is that we were filming them in shadow, which helped out. But then to give everything in the background, to give all the, you know, the correct sort of contrast so that it matched the rest of the photography and the whole sequence, we did everything that you've just been talking about to really push the drama of the lighting in the background and give some interest in the plate.
And so, I mean, the folding has a inherently obvious problem, which is just lack of space preserving. I mean, you can't have buildings folding on buildings without either cheating somewhere or having buildings collapsing as they run into each other. Sure. That didn't read like that in the cinema. How did you solve the inherent problem that there just isn't enough room for Paris to be folded on itself?
Well, you're right. You know, that was something we ran up against very, very early on when Alison was doing the previs. We had a lot of intersection problems with the buildings sliding through each other and everything. And for the most part, we just cheat them out. You know, so the buildings in the background, in the back rows, as they're tilting up and then pushing down inside the buildings in the foreground, we just slip them back a little bit so their facades are just behind the facades of the buildings that they're coming to meet. And so you don't get any of the obvious through projections, and you would hide the more ugly things behind roof lines and things like that. The camera is also very carefully designed to hide the really egregious stuff. So just as it really starts to get bad, the camera drifts off it, and you just don't see it happening. So that helps us. And that's a sort of, you know, I think that's a perfectly valid cinematic cheat to actually use.
Yeah, sure. I mean, apart from anything else, her subconscious isn't going to be dealing with that problem. It's going to just imagine it can be solved.
No. And also, you know, there's what we also were trying to imply is that Ariadne is reshaping the whole thing as she does this.
Yeah.
So when the buildings finally close together and they close across the line across the dormer units at the top of one of the buildings, and the idea is that the roofs are interlocking together and pushing down inside each other, more like teeth meshing together, and it's as if Ariadne has built the roofs.
Because when I was watching it, I was thinking, well, I could just imagine a discussion on set, which is like, it's creatively valid that they don't clash because obviously inside the story it is. And I can imagine on set or even in some pre-production meeting, someone just saying, we'll just fix it. And you guys going, well, that's all very well and true to say, but we still have to have a shot where the audience doesn't go, hey, that building just went through that other building.
Well, you know, this is one of the things I've learned from working with Chris is that you can get away with an awful lot in terms of you can just cut around things to actually hide things that you don't want to see, and the audience is so used to seeing that sort of thing in filmmaking that a problem is just made to go away by just not showing it. Then it just doesn't become an issue. And when you start analysing any visual effects film or indeed any kind of action sequence, you begin to think, well, how could you survive that? You know, or yeah, how did the car get there? You know, it's all part of the way that films are put together. But a bigger challenge with the whole street folding sequence was not the intermeshing of the buildings. It was actually the lighting of the scene, because the previs was pretty much flat lit. You know, the lighting was all baked into the buildings, and so we didn't have any issues with shadows going in the wrong place or whatever like that. And of course, if you really built a great big roof over the street, you'd block out the sun altogether and you'd plunge it into complete darkness. And I think I spotted somebody on the internet complaining about that. I think there's bigger issues to worry about in the whole thing than that. But Paris is being folded into a cube and people are walking on the ceiling. But but it had a practical dimension, which was obviously, as the buildings folded over, it occluded our CG light sources, and we got these huge shadows running across the streets, and then eventually we lost all the light from the scene. And some of that we then incorporated into the design of the shot. So you get the shadows running across the street, and that's a very powerful, dramatic accent in the shot. And so that was something we decided to keep. But then we came up with this idea of, well, maybe it isn't entirely closed, this universe, that there are little gaps still in it. And you see one at the very end of that shot. You can see open sky still that's admitting sunlight. So we're suggesting that there are additional light sources that could bring the light in. But
it's valid if she can just imagine that it's lit. It's creatively valid right the way through.
Exactly.
It just has to not look wrong on screen.
That's it. And I think, again, the lighting artists excelled themselves by coming up with a very, very subtle series of lighting changes through that whole big shot, which we actually did that shot as one continuous shot. It was about, I think it was well over 1,000 frames long, and then it was chopped up, I think, into four bits for the film. But for a long time, we were working on it just as one continuous piece, so it had to work as one self-contained bit. You couldn't just cheat between the cuts and just say, okay, we switched to another lighting scenario. We actually had the lighting changes occurring.
From a technical point of view, one of your signature aspects of cityscapes is the ability of the team to get something happening inside the room rather than being like a flat card behind a theoretical glass. Did you get Paris rooms, or how did that work?
Yeah, we did. We shot what we call window box textures of interiors of the various hotel rooms we stayed in. We got inside some of the houses on the streets in Paris and shot interiors there.
So everyone that was staying in Paris had to basically make sure that their room was photographed.
Pretty much. that's kind of how it worked. And then we had, we even got inside the shops down at street level. Some of the shopkeepers were very, very helpful and embraced the whole appearance of the film unit. Other people just put brown paper over the windows and went away on holiday.
How good is your French? Trying to explain that. Oh, my God.
Well, fortunately, I have a lot of French colleagues who can do the speaking for me.
Yeah, I'm sure. That sequence is incredibly impressive. And the other sequence that's sort of related is the mirror sequence as she becomes slightly more confident in her ability as an architect and designer. And you've got to walk me through that, because I sat there looking at it going, hang on a second, this would have taken what? What did you do? I couldn't work it out. And I'm sure that it's going to be like one of my favorite bits of the DVD to try and play that back frame by frame and work out what's going on where.
Well, I'm glad you felt that way about it. That's exactly what we were hoping for. And I think actually it's so subtly done that I think most people don't even think anything's been done there. They just think, wow, they just had a couple of big mirrors on the set. but that was a fantastic example of the whole kind of, Chris Nolan's collaborative approach to filmmaking, in that he had written a scene in the script in which Leo and Ellen walk out of the Common Ariadne, walk out of the cube street environment. They go into a tunnel, a foot tunnel, which then brings them out into a green field, and then Ariadne starts conjuring up more buildings around the edge of it. But it just didn't really seem to work. I mean, nobody was coming up with particularly good ideas of where we could actually shoot this thing and how the buildings would develop and what have you. And Chris felt that it was more important to actually keep that in Paris itself, recognisably Paris. And so instead it became this idea of Ariadne taking a journey through Paris, which obviously she's been studying in as a student. And so she's playfully exploring the possibilities of that this dream world offers to her. And one location we looked at was this extraordinary bridge, the Pont du Bir Hakeim, I think it's pronounced, which is this combination footbridge and rail bridge that runs across the Seine near to the Eiffel Tower, which if your eagle-eyed viewers will spot the Eiffel Tower, pops up very briefly in the background. I think the only time it appears in the film, even though it kind of loomed over us a lot of the time when we were shooting. And we were looking at this bridge, and it's got this extraordinary set of repeating metal arches on the footbridge part of it. And I mentioned to Chris, I said, well, you know, it reminds me a little bit of a series of, you know, the infinite reflections in two opposing mirrors, like a hall of mirrors effect. And, of course, mirrors feature in a couple of places in the film later on, and we'd already discussed, you know, the significance of reflections and kind of the way that you could play with them and turn them into reality. And we started to think, well, how can we actually incorporate this into the film? And we discussed all sorts of different ideas about how this thing might appear as a series of reflections. And eventually Chris just said, well, what if we took a giant mirror with us to the location and actually shot there with a giant mirror? What would that give you? And so I got together with Chris Corbold. And Chris Corbold came up with a way of actually building a sort of giant mirrored door. It was 8 foot by 16 feet, and it swung on hinges. It was supported by a very substantial rig, and it weighed so much. I think it weighed about 800 pounds, the mirror. So, you know, in the film, you see Ellen pulling it quite easily, but in reality, it was being pushed by two or three burly special effects guys behind what Chris Corbold referred to as a mandrolic rig. So we had a lot of mandrolic rigs on this show. And we took the mirror there. But before we did that, we spent a bit of time in Previs. And again, this is how Previs works in this process. We used Previs to explore the possibilities of what we could achieve with an 8 by 16 foot mirrored door. And what kind of shots could we actually come up with that? And we only had one of these mirrors. We had a sort of secondary Mylar mirror, but it didn't really give very good reflections. And we came up with a little sequence of shots and offered them up to Chris. And we said, well, we could do it like this. And the mirror is of a certain size. We can hide bits of it behind the pillars. You know, it was obvious right away that we were going to have to do a lot of extension and replacement work on the day, on the shots after we'd got them. So we took the mirror there, and it... Chris Corbold's team rigged it and then wheeled the thing into place. And we shot that scene in a couple of hours, early one morning. And it's all handheld. And of course, you know, the mirror then just reflected everything we didn't want to see.
I was going to say, like, it's all very well talking about having a mirror on set, but quite often you absolutely don't want mirror things on set.
No, precisely. And of course, we're looking directly into the mirror a lot of the time. So, yeah, you know, we're getting reflections of Leo and Ellen, and we're getting some useful reflections of the bridge environment. We're also seeing the rig, and we're seeing the entire shooting crew. So the mirror door would swing shut, and there would be Chris crouching behind Wally and Bob Hall, our focus puller, and, you know, the key grip and a whole bunch of people that you didn't really want to see.
So I guess if someone was to say, why bother even at all with the mirror, the thing the mirror gave you that you otherwise didn't have is the other side of the actors.
Exactly. Well, it gave us the other side of the actors, and it's very important for the actors to have something so they can understand what they're supposed to be doing as well. So there's actually something physically there. It's the same principle as taking them to the location and saying, don't pretend you're in Paris. You are in Paris. You know, don't just imagine there's a mirror there. Here, we've given you a mirror so you can actually look at this thing and interact with it.
Yeah, but I mean, if she was pulling on a green screen panel, mm-hmm. theoretically camera over her, behind her, then you're going to get her back. You don't get her performance, which you don't get from the mirror.
Exactly. Yeah, and the mirror, exactly. The mirror gives us that very useful element. But also, the mirror, it was very important to Chris that the mirror feel real. And I think that's actually the key to this whole sequence, is the mirror, even though we've replaced the mirror in, for the most part throughout the whole sequence with a CG mirror, it moves and shakes and wobbles like the real mirror, because we match-moved the mirror and all of the movement of the reflections in the mirror and then reproduced all of the distortion of warp and the wobble of the glass as it bended and flexed.
Yeah, that was something that really impressed me, that it didn't feel like it was a composited plate that was flat. It felt like it was a composited sort of warping, distorting, without being ridiculous kind of mirror.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, we wanted that, you know, the little shiver when the door closes and it wobbles slightly. Chris really wanted, he wanted to retain the little lines in the panels, between the panels of the mirror, but he didn't want it to look like just one seamless, perfect, impossibly large mirror. So you're seeing all these things which tell you it's real, but then what we're doing is we're extending the mirror, because 8 foot by 16 foot is pretty big, but it's not as big as we needed. We needed a huge mirror that just went up 30 feet up into the ceiling. So, you know, we are creating the CG mirror, but basing it off the action of the real mirror. And then the inter-reflections that you see between the two mirrors, those are entirely digital, created with ray tracing between two virtual mirrors. And we had a very detailed model of the bridge that we built from the whole, you know, from the whole survey process that we had before.
One of the few occasions that you had to wind up the bounce number on your ray tracing to absurd levels, no doubt.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, it's interesting from my point of view as the supervisor of the show. Everything went through really smoothly. You know, I'd ask, we'd kick stuff off rendering, and it'd always be there in the morning. There was very rarely did we have to wait any, you know, any more than a day to get renders out in any of the sequences. And however, the head of DNEG's tech department, Dave Scott, he told me that on a per shot basis, this was by far and away the most, what he described as the most significant render stroke server abuse that had gone through the facility so far.
Yeah, because I mean, even if you're doing a digital car, you may only get a two levels of bounces, and there must have been like 50 or more on that.
It was a lot. I'm not entirely sure how many they did. Eventually, you kind of lose the reflections.
Yeah.
The sort of, you know, so that is the, you know, the saving grace of real mirrors. If you're trying to produce a real mirror look, is that eventually the reflections go to mush. But it was pretty intense. And then there was a huge amount of rotoscoping and match moving to separate Leo and Ellen from the environment. And, you know, pretty much after she closes that first mirror door, everything you're seeing in there is CG until she breaks the mirrors.
Well, now I have two other things I wanted to discuss with you just before we finish. And just quickly, there's been a lot of speculation that this is a personal essay on the nature of filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
Was it articulated at any form? I mean, was the original script pretty much like what you ended up with? Was how much is that just people reading stuff into it, and how much is it every film is a personal statement?
Well, I think with Chris, all of his films are personal statements, and you can see aspects of himself when you get to know him, and you can, you know, his interests and his ideas, you know, reoccur throughout all of his movies. And there's obviously clear similarities between this film, or clear comparisons, should I say, between this film and, say, Memento, you know, his breakthrough picture.
Which is still one of my all-time favourite films.
Yes, it's an extraordinary film, that, I have to say. And this, I describe this film to people as, say, well, you kind of take, you know, take the action from The Dark Knight and you stick it into the structure of Memento, and you're kind of beginning to get close to what, approach what, Inception is going to be. But in terms of the way the script developed, you know, the initial draft was pretty much finished. Chris continues to update it. He'd always have the script with him. We'd be scouting, you know, we'd be flying somewhere on a plane, and we'd have a discussion about something on the plane, and then you'd see him sit back down in his seat, he'd be thinking, and then he'd pull the script out of his bag and start writing stuff and making notes. And then a couple of days later, new pages would come out, and the things that you'd been talking about 2 days ago were now part of the script, you know, little tweaks and stuff. And he was continually refining and honing it all the way through. The actual, yeah, it's, I think it is very definitely, it reflects the nature of filmmaking. I was actually thinking about the film today, thinking about Inception and comparing it to Francois Truffaut film, Day for Night. Or is it Night for Day? I can't remember. But, which is about a film crew making a film and all the challenges of actually making a film. And you can actually see the, you know, the different dream levels, which Chris was very keen to distinguish them from each other visually so that you would know where you always were. But each one is like, you know, they're different scenes from the life of a movie production. And it was a fascinating process to see. And, you know, coming back to the mirror sequence there, you know, we discussed a lot about what is the actual nature of a filmed image, that we wanted something which was visually arresting. And we wanted this sort of almost this homemade feel to it. The fact that she's got a real mirror and it's got a handle on it and things like that. But we just wanted to make sure we didn't step over the wrong side of the line and effectively step outside the film and end up looking back into it and see all the workings of how we were doing things. So it's it was a very interesting process, very intellectually stimulating, I have to say.
Yeah, and so rewarding that it was such an intellectually honest film. It wasn't pulling punches so that an audience would... it wasn't dumbing it down. But I have one very, very important technical point that I need to discuss with you, if it's possible. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you... Sure. You got a lot of material that was sent to you from set, and you would have seen various cuts. Paul, and I ask you this partly as a friend, does the top fall over after it cut to black?
Well, it's a real top, and it did really fall over eventually. But does it in the film, in the mind of the film, does it really fall over or does it not? You know, what was Chris thinking?
Go on, you've got to let me know.
My take on it is that I think Chris has a definitive answer to that. You know, as far as Chris is concerned, that top either stops spinning or it doesn't stop spinning. But he never told us what it did throughout the whole making of the film. He always kept it ambiguous. I remember we had quite an extensive discussion about it whilst we were scouting in Paris, and we were thinking about other films that had ambiguous endings, and he was comparing them to that, and he was saying, yes, well, you know, there's aspects of that in what we're doing here, and he says all of his films have ambiguous endings, but I think you should see it more as basically it's Chris's invitation to the viewer to reassess everything that they've just seen and really think about how did the story work, how did the plot work. If it is all a dream, or at what point does Cobb go into the dream and does he not come out? You know, everything in there is significant. Everything you see on the screen is absolutely intended. You know, I've noticed on the discussion boards, people have said, well, you know, the kids look exactly the same as they do in his dreams. Therefore, it must still be a dream. But actually, those are different actors playing the kids. They are slightly older than the kids you see in the dreams. And that's not just a coincidence. That's very intentional.
Oh, look, I'm right up there. I mean, if I was the sort of person that posted on boards, I think there was some point in the film that I sort of mentally noted that Leo hadn't checked his top when he came back from a sequence. And I was all ready to sort of like try and work out a line from that point somewhere through the film to the end. But by the end of it, I just was willing to go with, I was going to have a happier life if for me personally, the top fell over. And I was okay with that. I could move forward happy in the knowledge that I could live with that. Thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome, Mike. Thanks for having me on the show.
And congratulations to all the team. Because, I mean, like, you know, we say these things, but honestly, it's a magnificent film. And there's a lot of discussion about doing stuff in camera. But obviously, from our point of view, the work that Double Negative did is so beautifully integrated in the film. And it's just a masterpiece. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate it.
I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. I really love the podcast with Paul Franklin. Mike and Paul have such a great rapport. It's just nice to hear them talking about the film in such detail. And what a great film. If you haven't seen it, you now know a lot more about it, but I really hope you do go and see it. I know I'll be seeing it many times and looking forward to what Christopher Nolan does next and what Paul does next. So anyway, that'll do it for this podcast. Thanks for joining us. For my partners, Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, thanks for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.